Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the Olive Podcast. I'm Janine, Olive's deputy editor and podcast host, and each week I'll be catching up with fascinating characters from the food world as they share stories, advice, and expertise. I'm delighted to welcome back Sabrina Gill, best-selling author of 7 books, chef, supper club host, and Persian food expert to the podcast. Sabrina's first book, Persiana, has just been re-released as a special 10-year anniversary edition. So we thought we'd invite her back to talk about her incredible journey so far and get a few of her amazing tips and tricks along the way, as always. How are you doing, Sabrina?
I'm good, thanks. Good. How are you?
I'm good. I know that you've just got back from Bangkok, so... Well, a big trip was Bangkok, Cambodia.
Yeah, I went out there with my boys, my husband and my stepsons, and I just, they'd never been, and I just had to introduce them because, as you know, Bangkok is my love. I love Thailand so much, and I also love Cambodia, like Siem Reap to go and see Angkor Wat, and so we kind of surprised that trip on them like the night before we were leaving. So, yeah, just because, but you know, teenage boys, not great at exhibiting excitement. Yeah. Everything's just boring.
Or getting up at 4 a.m.
Yeah, so they were super excited. It was a very nice surprise and also really different. So for them, it was for me, I think selfishly, I just was like, this is everything, every reaction I wanted. This is all those reactions.
I love it.
It was mad. So,
well,
yeah.
Thank you for fighting through the jet lag and coming in. So first of all, can you take us back to that time when you'd got the book deal for Persiana, because this was your first book, and I believe it was on the back of those amazing supper clubs that you were hosting at your little flat around the corner in West Kensington.
Yeah.
And I say little flat because I've been there, and it's a small flat for a supper club, isn't it?
It really is. It was I think it was 2013 when my now publisher walked in, and she was just like, oh my God, this food is amazing. We want to give you a book deal. And I was like, okay, great. Yeah. Thanks very much for coming. Bye.
Don't think she was
ready. Yeah, because people come in with the best of intention and say the loveliest things. Yeah. But I think for me, until I'm somebody who works on hard evidence of things, so I just put everything to the back burner until there's like proof of it. So she messaged me the next day and, you know, got in contact with my agent, sent a book proposal of what they would like from me.
Yeah.
And I went through the recipe list and I was like, yep, great. Oh, these are actually my recipes. They've done really well. They've kind of gone through all my catering menus and like, you know, supper club menus. And I thought, that's good. Wait, what? Baba ganoush? No. Tell them no. And my agent was like, why? And I was like, no, I don't want to write the book that like everyone has ever written about Middle Eastern food. I don't want to be predictable. I don't, Baba Ganoush is already out there. You don't need me to write a recipe. And she was like, all right, calm down. Like, I was so adamant that if I did do a book, I just didn't want it to be, you know, a reprint of just everything else that's ever been written. I wanted to do something a little bit different. Not mind-blowing, not crazy, nothing, you know, sensational, but just something that was just different. I wanted to be me.
Yeah, it was very, very much a book where your voice is absolutely at the forefront.
Yeah, and it's not like a romantic book, you know, like tied to my mother's apron strings. Because in my case, that would be I learned nothing because she didn't have an apron and she wasn't anywhere near the kitchen. You know, it's an unconventional story.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually want to tell a story. I wasn't looking to tell a story. I was just trying to make Middle Eastern food really easy for people based on largely supermarket ingredients so that they would actually cook it.
I like that. And I think in the front of the book, you've written a new introduction and you actually say 10 years ago, your intro to the book said Middle Eastern cookery is often shrouded in mystery, but now it's firmly into the mainstream. And I mean, you've been a big part of that.
I mean, yeah, with quite a few other people. Yeah. I think Honey & Co. came out the exact same year. Love those guys. And, you know, Ottolenghi, of course. And we were all slightly doing something different that didn't tread on each other's toes and had a very sort of different accent. So I think together that became really quite powerful. And I remember, you know, even kind of a famous supermarket producing a report at the end of the year saying, you know, we've totally changed our offering on the shelves and we've seen rose petals and pomegranate molasses and, you know, pistachios and things fly off the shelves. And they credited, you know, my book as part of that report. And I was like, yeah, this is pretty big deal. You know, I didn't think it was going to be, you don't think that, you don't think, you know, I just kept thinking, oh my God, who is going to buy this book? Like, this could go really badly if nobody wants to know about this book. But, you know, I was very wrong. And it was a much bigger deal than any of us would have anticipated. But I just had this weird, I don't know what it is. I'm a bit witchy. And it sounds silly to say it at the time when everyone just thinks you're just batty. But I remember.
But you felt it.
I did. But I didn't know what would happen, though. I didn't have like, oh, this is going to happen and you're going to be the queen and win the lottery. You know, it wasn't like that. I just sort of thought, I don't know what's going on, but I got this feeling about this book. I can't explain it or even paint a picture as to what's going to happen, but I've got a feeling about this book. Mm. And they were like, okay. You know, like all the people on my sheet were just humoring me like, all right. So now I'm like, ha, I told you. Do you remember that day? And then they're like, yeah, you're right. But it wasn't, everybody was like, God, it was such a huge overnight success. And I'm like, it really wasn't.
Right.
It was not a slow burn, but I would say a slow and sensible burn. It took, you know, you have to bear in mind that I was doing a lot of catering, a lot of supper clubs. My reach to everyday people at home was quite large because I was just feeding a lot of people at that time. I was teaching cookery classes everywhere, up and down London, you know, anywhere that people wanted to have a meal and cook for me, I went, you know, because I had no money. So I was working all the time. So I went into loads of people's homes and did dinner parties for 40, 60 people all on my own, you know, with a sholly, like a shopping trolley and on the tubes because I couldn't afford taxis and I can't drive.
Wow.
So there was a lot of unglamorous foundation work in the background. And I think that when my book came out, those same people were like, oh my God, like, that's that lovely girl that did the catering for us, because they were quite affluent. And I think that word of mouth is always the best word of mouth, especially a cookbook is dinner parties. Even if you're like, all right, mate, everybody come round to dinner, just pile on. It doesn't have to be fancy, but there's nothing better than someone cooking a recipe and me going around, God, Janine, that bread that you made the other day. And you were like, well, that was, you know, so-and-so's recipe. Yeah. I'm going to go home, buy the book, probably make it as well. So that helped massively. And come Christmas, from May to Christmas, that's when it really started to pick up, was Christmas time.
I mean, we know like cookbooks are a lottery because I've talked to loads of publishers and they publish so many books each year. And
great cookbooks
great ones.
Cookbooks.
And, you know, some of them go big, some of them, some beautiful, incredible ones hardly sell anything. What do you think it is about you? I mean, and we're talking about the book, but what it is about you and your food that's so unique and that just connects with people?
I mean, I wish there was a camera on my face right now. I'd like to take myself away from it because I look at my books as the you know, it's Persiana, it's not really me, is it? But I think right place, right time is one key factor that nobody was doing Persian food, yeah. Middle Eastern food led by Persian first.
Yes.
Because, you know, ottolenghi is Middle Eastern food led by pan Middle Eastern right. with a sort of Jewish accent. And then Honey and Co. are also kind of like Middle Eastern food, but with an Israeli accent. And then we all kind of spread out into yeah. different areas. So, I could fill those shoes quite nicely. But really, moreover, ottolenghi and Honey and Co. are restaurateurs. And I'm not a restaurateur. Mm. I am a home cook that worked in and around the food industry my whole career, because I worked in hotels and restaurants, not as a chef before. And I have been cooking since I was a kid. So I know a lot about how we feel at home. I don't think with a chef's head about ingredients and putting things together. I'm not trying to create a song out of my recipes. I'm just trying to create something yummy using minimal ingredients that's not going to cost the earth and won't make you think, God, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah.
You know, I am more the home cook, and that it does that kind of does trump a lot of
If you can open a recipe, look at it, think that looks amazing. I've got most of those ingredients. I can do that.
Or that you feel maybe, I don't have that, but that will be fine.
Yeah. You've mentioned that, you know, your mum doesn't cook.
Didn't,
and your grand doesn't
never had.
Never had. Can you remember what that first little kind of spark was that just made you think like, oh, this is amazing, I can do this, or I can, you know, you got excited about cooking something?
I mean, fair play to my mum. It's a godsend for all that she doesn't actually cook, so I wouldn't be here to live to tell this tale, but she loves food.
Yeah.
She does love food, and she is very opinionated and was always very curious and very cool and being on trend with things. This is the early 80s. There weren't that many food trends.
No.
But like, she was like, I'm going to take you for salami. And I was like, what? What's that? Because it wasn't a thing in England. You know, we're like, that sounds a bit, you know, batty. But like, there wasn't salami in supermarkets. You could barely get garlic. Ginger wasn't a thing,
you know.
So she used to take me to like food at Benihana, like teppanyaki. What? Having chef throw stuff at you, on the counter. And she was like, we're going to eat a croissant today. Like, because you couldn't find those things anywhere. There were no supermarket sort of like, there weren't food halls, you know, it was quite a new thing. So, well, she would think nothing of driving like 60 miles to go for Afghani food. Like,
wow.
She made me excited for food, and then watching Ken Hom on the BBC and Madda Jaffrey made me think, oh, I love this.
Those were great people though, weren't they?
They were, and I was very young. I was captivated. I think they came out in about 82, 83, I'm not wrong. And I was like six, something like that. And I was, six, seven. And I was like, whoa, this is mega. And then, you know, the wok revolution hit and jarred sauces from a famous uncle came out. And, you know, it enabled you to mess around in the kitchen. And she saw that spark, that love for it. And she was just like, I wasn't allowed to do this, so you do it. Like, if you want to, if that makes you happy, do it. So, you know, there's me and I for wok and on our those coiled up electric cobs, those like that just glow orange when they're hot. So
they were absolutely lethal.
Yeah, but you know, to this day, I still have never had a gas hob in my house, which I think people are like, you're a chef and you don't cook with gas. I'm like, nope. But I write all my recipes based on sort of gas recipes, because you need to the worst case scenario it, shall we say. So it was those moments with my mom messing around in the kitchen, and combined with that time that these chefs were on TV, that made it for me.
I brought my copy of Persiana with me.
Lovely.
I thought we could just go through and maybe you could pick like two or three hero recipes from it that you think have become, you know, synonymous with you in your cooking. And
so I would say it's always good to pick a kofta. I'm a kofta queen.
I was going to say that. I was rereading it yesterday and today. And
there's a lot of koftas in
there. There's a lot of koftas in there. There was things that popped up. I was like, oh yeah, that one. I'm going to see if you pick what I picked, but kofta was definitely on there.
So the koftas, always my thing, because I always think that one of the greatest gifts from the meat world is mince.
Yeah.
I just love mince.
Love mince.
My butcher in Yorkshire always just takes the piss, because I'm like, I'm like, can I have 12 pouches of minced lamb this spec? And he's just like, is that Sabrina? And I'm like, yes, it's me. Because he's like, I always know it's you because you only ever order mince. So, lamb and sour cherry meatballs were a big signature off the back of my supper clubs and my catering, I would say. Anything lamb that I did, but I can't just pick three lamb things, so I'm not going to. But it's usually the aubergine dishes, rice dishes, lamb dishes, those kind of ilk of things, and that carrot, I call it that carrot cake, because I had to make so many thousands of it that I just...
Don't want to see it again.
It's not that I never want to see it again. I just don't have an appetite for it. It's
really
lovely cake.
Yeah.
It freezes well. It's great for, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner. You can do them in muffin molds. It's just so giving. But literally, I baked thousands of it.
Wow.
And I have just, you know, gone my separate ways from it. So that's a real signature one, because it's the cake to make every new baker feel like they can be successful in the kitchen, because it doesn't have flour in it.
Yeah.
It's very forgiving. You can chop and change the ingredients. If you've got an almond allergy, you can use hazelnut. You can use whatever you like.
So it's an almond-based cake.
Yeah, so it's got almond, coconut, pistachio, carrots.
Ooh, lovely.
It's really, it's a really, really nice cake, actually, to be fair. And you can, I used to bake them in muffin molds for my customers, for clients, for dinner, and just peel them back. So you get your own individual one. And clients would always say, I love your cake. Like, I froze your cake. It just freezes so well. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then I would try that and think, okay, that's great. Now I can tell people, like, if you're only going to eat half the cake, freeze it. Like, portion it out. It's the gift that keeps on giving. So, and then I would say salads, big deal for me. Salads are still a big deal for me.
Breakfast salad.
Yeah. My mate Millie, who now is actually chief boss at Ottolenghi Kitchens, she always said to me, you're a salad queen. I do love a salad, but usually very rarely do my salads have lettuce in them.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not probably salad that people are thinking of at
home. It's not wet, soggy salad.
No, it's very sort of hearty,
you know. Robust, but actually the underlying tone is it's always healthy. Don't tell anyone, I don't. Just don't say anything. Because healthy has just got such a bad rep, hasn't it? I don't do healthy food, but I do really balanced food.
But you do kind of nourishing food.
Yeah, you don't need to think about it.
Yeah.
You know, this cake
this
covered in salted caramel and bananas and peanut butter is not healthy. But I think I've even over the years had so many nutritionists say, you know, dietitians say that we just, of all the diet books and all that crap, we do recommend your books a lot because it's very balanced.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because I don't like, you know, I don't like making food that's massively unhealthy, but it's not in the back of my mind like, oh my God, I've got to cook this and it's got to be really low fat. I don't care about those things, but I do like flavor, nice flavors and fresh flavors.
Yeah. And I think balance is a good word.
Yeah.
When you mentioned your koftas, you were talking about, because one of the things I was going to pick up is that kind of fruit and meat thing, which you said is very Persian.
Very Persian.
And you've got things like barberries as well, which I think I might have had before. They're quite sour.
Yes. Yeah, they're tiny little. So they do grow in England as well. Okay. They were quite prevalent in the time of Henry VIII in his kitchen. Tiny little red berries that look like goji berries, but are a little bit more bright red.
Okay.
And they're just very sharp and sour in a really nice sort of lemony way, but with a little pop of fruit. And they do grow in England. But I imagine that we probably wouldn't know what to do with them without that. But, you know, sticking to the healthy theme, we Persians like to fry them in butter and sugar. Mostly, and fold them into rice, which sounds crap, but it is
really
so delicious. Yeah. And I like to use them in things, in meatball mixtures.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do use them in a couple of authentic Persian kofta recipes as well. So they're just yummy. But, like, moreover, for Western use, I would just make a butter compound out of, like, a couple of generous fistfuls of barberries blitzed with butter, whatever seasonings you want in there, and then just use that on fish. Because it's like tart, but without that acerbic acid that almost cooks fish.
Yeah.
So it's a lovely way of adding citrus vibes to something, but without that sharp sort of acidity that would almost cook something off.
And that kind of sour note is a flavour as well, because I know you use dried limes, which yeah. I've had. You've mentioned pomegranate molasses. Mm-hmm. So there's always that kind of
Persians love yeah. sour, Janine. Honestly, I have to stop my mother from introducing half this stuff to my youngest because I'm worried he's going to strip his teeth of enamel because she's got him sucking lemons and like all kinds. He loves it. He just, those two are thick as thieves. And I'm just like, you know, he's a kid and this is like yeah. his first set of teeth. Stop, you know, you can't just keep giving him these things.
Because sour is one of the last flavours that we kind of, as children, like we don't like sour, do we? It's something that we kind
of... Yeah, I don't know about. But, I don't know yeah. about the new generation because of things like, you know, sour fizzy sweets. They do
oh, yeah.
now love
that,
it.
Yeah, and the sherbet we used to have, didn't we?
Yeah. That sherbet is soft compared to some of the stuff that the kids rock up with. I'm yeah. like, it's horrible, some of their stuff. But yeah, sour is a big thing. Persians love sour. They love lemons. They love, let's say, lemons with salt on it. And even in while we were in Bangkok, my kids... observing the cracky things that my mother does. She's got passion fruit, and she'd cut the passion fruit open and then sprinkled salt on it.
Okay. Is that just her invention or is that...
Oh, no, I mean, it's perfectly common. We eat cucumbers with salt. We eat lemon with salt. We eat cherries with salt. We... I don't, but it's very normal. They okay. do it.
Yeah.
I think it's a hot country thing, you know, yeah. like the Thais put like chili salt on things and chili sugar on...
Mangoes and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it balances...
It's electrolytes.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Yeah, so we have that kind of vibe, and he's like part Persian, like oddly, even though he's not my DNA, I kind of feel like he's inherited...
He's quite,
yeah, because his favourite fruit is watermelon, and I'm like, this kid is literally, you know, pretty yeah. much Persian. His name is Ollie. We could just call him Ali, because it's just like, he is so Persian in some senses. It's unreal.
Do you think since you've become, because you got married a few years ago, didn't you?
Yeah.
And you have got these they're stepsons.
Yeah.
Do you think your cooking's changed since you acquired a family?
Most definitely. I think I spent the first few months of our overall relationship yeah. as a family just sobbing in the kitchen because they were like, ugh, of like quite a lot of stuff that I made. They were just not used to it.
Yeah.
And they were just like, ugh, it's burnt. And I'm like, it's not burnt. That's a pizza oven. And this is what you do to a pizza crust. It's called bruciata. You know, things wasted. They're like, yeah, it's burnt. You know, or charring meat and things like
yeah.
that. They used to be so arsy about it, so difficult. And I remember one day saying to my husband in the kitchen, I was like, I'm like, you know, it's just so debilitating that they don't like anything. Now I'm kind of a big deal. Like, people pay for my food, you know. And he was just like, he's like, babe, these are kids. This is everyone's kids are the same.
Yeah.
And I think he was just like, don't take it personally because it will change again. And then they'll
yeah.
love it and then they'll hate it again. And now obviously I'm much deeper into family life and have saved myself by speaking to so many other people. They're like,
really?
Yeah, he likes it. And then the next day he won't. It. And I realize that it's utterly normal. But now they're actually really quite progressive.
That's
so
good.
There are things that I definitely know that one won't eat because
yeah.
the little one's a little bit more tricky. And I know what all his safe areas are. But he's the, you know, I'll try that for a dare kid.
I was going to ask you, like, what are the things that you've always got in your cupboard and fridge that make you feel safe? Like, what are your safe ingredients that you know, I've got this in my cupboard, I've got this in my fridge, I've got this in my freezer, and I can make something.
I was going to say, when I open my cupboard, safety is about the last thing on my mind, because when you open my cupboards, it's like a kind of duck.
Yeah,
like, you never know what's going to... And like glass things have fallen out on my head before. My cupboards are an absolute nightmare.
Do you do like a regular recce and
no,
clearing out?
No.
You just put stuff on top.
Just literally, it's just any millimetre of space.
Yeah.
There's just something. But, you know, that's because I also live in Yorkshire now and I don't drive and I live in a village.
Yeah.
So I've got everything, you know, and I always did, even
yeah.
pre-COVID. I was always a hoarder anyway, but not a hoarder of ridiculous things. I do use everything, but I have like every pulse known to man dried and tinned.
Yeah.
Every type of noodle from every culture, just in case.
Yeah.
bomba rice, paella rice, risotto rice, Persian rice, jasmine rice, long grain rice, pudding rice, you know, I have it all. Basmati rice. Oh, I've got a 15 kilo bag of that, you know. They, you know, my youngest always says, your kitchen is like a supermarket. I've never seen a house like it. And I said, well, get used to this because my kitchen is my office. Yeah. You forget that. So there, it's, I like to keep ingredients for any eventuality. I think that's quite important for me. There's not always one pack of butter. There's always like four. But I have five people in the house.
Yeah.
Right. That's one thing. I can't afford to run out of mayonnaise or ketchup because that there will be a kickoff. And the remedy is an 8 mile drive. It's not short thing. So so I have to be quite organized
in
that
sense. So
your
Yorkshire kitchen really, it really is the place where you have to have stuff stocked up because
I've got like,
you can't just pop out to the shops.
I've got a double fridge in the kitchen. And then that's to replace the short under the counter fridge that was there when we moved in, that the kind people before us left us. And then because the short under the counter fridge wasn't enough for me when the boys moved in, I bought another short under the counter fridge, and then that wasn't enough, so I bought a full size fridge. So, and that goes with a chest freezer in the garage. There's two fridges in the garage plus a chest freezer. We got rid of one of the small under the counter fridges. I mean, that's how Persians roll.
Is it? Yeah.
Like, English people might be freaking out hearing this and going, well, that's just excessive. Persians would be like, yep, totally standard. Yeah. Asians will be like, yeah, my dad fills the shoe. Like, I know my art director on this book. She's like, yeah, my dad has a shed and all it is in there is rice, tin staples, dried spices and toilet paper.
Yeah.
Like pre-COVID as well. So we don't like to run out of stuff. We like to have everything.
Yeah, I know this because I've been to your house for... what was meant
for
to
an
be
apocalyptic
like,
feast?
Well, it was meant to be like, you're like, oh, don't, I'll just do something simple for us, and just kept bringing out dish after dish after dish, and I was like, okay, sorry.
But it was, you know, like that is a no stress sort of feast.
Yeah.
I think that's quite important to sort of say, listen, that's how we roll.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh my God, Janine from Olive Magazine is coming, and it's just like, well, I'm going to do this, this, and this. If I have the time to sit down with you, like, I'm going to use it. And sort of like make sure that it, you know, it's everything I want it to be, because we don't do one pot in my culture. It's not in my culture. So for me, it's quite important to feed you how I would feed myself. Like tonight, my mother is gracing me with her presence for dinner, which never happens because she's always out.
Always out.
And she said, I'm going to be home tonight. So if you want to do those artichokes. And I said, okay.
So you got told.
Yeah, so I got told. I said, all right, fine. And I said, I wanted to get a poussin if you want to split a poussin, because we're mostly eating veggie at the moment. Mm-hmm. And she said, yeah, no problem. She goes, what else are we going to have with it? And I said, well, you've got two huge globe artichokes and a poussin. What else do you want? She was like, well, you know, have you got any hummus? And I said, I don't want hummus. So she's like, what have you got? And I said, Mum, I just spent like £100 at the grocers, like literally buying fruit and vegetables and good stuff for the week, because I was craving
just
asparagus.
Craving it, yeah.
And, you know, so I've stocked up the house and I was like, we don't need anything. I've got spinach. I've got this. I got, you know, she needs lots of little plates, even though Persians don't eat meze. The word meze or mazze, it means to taste. And it's not in our culture, but we certainly like to eat lots of a variety of things,
a variety
at any
of different
meal.
Dishes. So do you think, I was saying, going back to that, you know, Persiana and your supper club, do you think that's another thing that really connected with people who came, because they weren't used to having that kind of family style food that now, you know, like you said in the book, it's kind of everywhere now, but then it wasn't.
No, and you're absolutely right. I think it was. I only realised because I was doing it.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't realise it in advance and then think, that's how I'm going to roll. I remember the first time I wrote a menu, I did a supper club hosted with someone else at the time. And he said, are you sure you want to do all that food? And I'm like, what? And he was like, that's a lot of food. And I said, but like, that's just normal. Like, we wouldn't even do that in two courses. We'd do that all as one course. And he was just like, his mind was blown. And I said, listen, if I'm going to do it, this is how we do it. The only thing I know I have to change is Persians don't eat pudding. And I said, Brits are going to hit the flipping roof if we serve them savoury food and not end in a pudding. Doesn't matter how much we fed them. I said, you know, I went to school here. I know we want pudding. So, and I said, and baklava is not going to cut it. So, yeah, I think it was probably quite useful from the sense that it was a winning formula for me, because if you didn't, let's say if you didn't even like one thing, because let's say maybe you didn't like tomatoes, there were still nine other dishes. So how could you not be happy? And more importantly, you'd be so full, but that happy full, not like a bleh full. People would say, I literally rolled out of your house last night, had the best time, but I don't even want breakfast this morning. I'm so happy from last night, you know. And I realized, like, that's a thing. That's quite an important tool. And it was about value. Like, I knew my food costs. I knew how to run food costs because I had a restaurant background. I knew how to observe health and safety in an environment where it wasn't regulated. You know, I knew how to keep my kitchen clean and do all of those things and not cross-contaminate. And I had two fridges. And I certainly kept those things in mind, because if I thought I came to somebody's house, I would hope that they would
do the same.
If they're going to be charging me for food, that they would do the same. But, you know, I've also heard horror stories. So
when you're looking back at the book and you look back at, say, your most recent book, do you think your recipe style has changed? I mean, it must have evolved in some ways. What kind of things do you think have changed for you?
I would say, you know, when I struck out with Persiana, I think I wanted to show people how to make a lot of traditional recipes, but like my way. Yeah. Like, it doesn't need to be this faff. It's like I've taught myself how to make it. So I haven't gone to my gran or my mum or some traditional place. I taught myself how to make it, and my easy version tastes exactly the same as it should. And like half the faff or more has been cut out for you.
Yeah.
So I was doing that based on recipes that were pre-existing at the time. And there were obviously, I would say probably the book was about 60-40. So 60% of recipes were definitely authentic, and then the rest were versions of or things that I'd made up. But now I would say that it's pretty much almost 80-20. 20% is still based on a lot of authentic recipes, and I don't like messing with them, but I have maybe changed the method to make it easier, or make it because you can now use X produce in a supermarket. But most of it is just my own.
It's your own interpretation. So you got more kind of confident with your own. I mean, you were always confident with your voice. I think even in rereading Persiana, like the intros, there's a lot of stuff in there about, you know, simplifying things and talking about different ingredients and stuff. It's a very confident book.
Yeah.
But I guess now it's probably a lot more of your things that you're waking up in the middle of the night thinking, well, that would be great to go with that.
Yeah, I think it's just always going to be a version of something I've always made. And I thought, why have I never, like, if my mum says, I'm craving this Persian recipe, and I'm like, oh, crap, I've never made that before.
Yeah.
But I know what it is and I grew up eating it, for example. And then I just, in my head goes like this, yeah, I think that should probably be made like this and with this. And yeah, that seems a straightforward, logical way of making that. And I do. And then I might Google, and it's hard to Google because Persians don't write recipes well. They go, a little bit of this, a pinch of that, this, an inch of this. And you're like, what? So I tend to make things, and then it comes, like my mum will say, oh, will you make that again? And I do. And then I'm thinking, actually, this is great. And I've made it so much easier. It's not £7. It's only one. Like, I need to be sharing this with people because I think Brits would love this.
Yeah.
So then they end up going through more rigorous testing to simplify and methodize and get measurements and things like that. So, and then it makes it into a book, you know. But now I just like fresh flavors, and I don't really know if my recipes quantify the label of Middle Eastern. I think they're more Sabrina food.
Yeah.
But you call me whatever you want.
Yeah.
Buy my book, call me whatever you want, label me in whatever section of your bookshop. I'm not precious about that.
Yeah.
It's like I just take whatever, you know, categorization whoever wants to put with you know, Grace, and I'm more than happy, because my only concern is the person at home, and if the recipe works, I don't give a toss about anything else.
Yeah.
I care that you're paying for my book and my recipe works and makes you feel confident yeah. that you have made something that was worth the time and the effort and the ingredient spend and gave you a boost and made you want to make more. Yeah. That's what makes me happy. Nothing else matters to me. Not my vanity, not what you did to my dish. If you tell me it was yummy and you're going to make it again, that's all that's all I want.
Job done. Well, it's such an amazing book. And thank you for coming to chat to us today and sharing all of your memories.
Thank you.
You know, hopefully there's going to be a whole new generation, a whole new audience for the book
I
again.
I hope so. I still think it's the gift that keeps on giving. It's great for people who just don't have a clue about Middle Eastern food, don't know where to start, and are petrified of things being overcomplicated. I'll say this book is perfect for you. It's the book that you probably didn't think you'd manage to tackle, but you'd be surprised at how straightforward it is.
And I'll just share your Instagram for people who want to catch up with you there. It's at Sabrina Gale.
Yes.
It? Yep. So people can find you there.
Bog standard,
yep.
Unusually.
You got your
just
name.
My
lucky.
Name. Yeah.
Thank you for coming to chat to us again, Sabrina.
Thank you.
That was the Olive Podcast. For more information, go to olivemagazine.com. And don't miss our Little Black Book bonus episodes, where guests give us their latest eating, drinking, and travel tips, out every Wednesday.